Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature three incredible interviews with debut novelists from our podcast-only series, Long Distance, hosted by Amanda Bullock. Back in the spring, as it became increasingly clear that COVID was going to interrupt our lives for much longer than a few weeks or months, we began to think about what else we could do to keep bringing our community great literary programming while we could not gather for readings and book launches. We returned to a long-held aspiration to launch a podcast that was more conversational in tone and one hosted by our own Amanda Bullock, who is our Director of Public Programs at Literary Arts. Amanda has an incredible taste when it comes to literature and an almost sixth sense for the books that will rise to the top at any given moment. The first episode of Long Distance was launched at the end of May, and we just finished up the sixth and final episode of the season. You can get them wherever you get your podcasts, but we also wanted to bring some of the highlights of the show to you, our radio audience. So for this episode of the Archive Project, Amanda chose three interviews with three exciting debut writers: Megha Majumdar, Jean Kyung Fraser, and Kelly Jo Ford. She spoke with them over Zoom from her home in Portland over the course of the spring and summer of 2020. So first, here's Amanda in conversation with Megha Majumdar.
So Megha, thank you so much for taking the time to talk today from Brooklyn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about A Burning. I would love to ask you to read a little bit from the book and tell us a little bit about it.
Great. I'm so happy to. So A Burning is my debut novel, and it's the story of three people in contemporary India who are chasing big dreams as society makes this dangerous turn toward right-wing extremism around them. And I can tell you very quickly about the three people. There's a woman who wants to ascend to the middle class, and she gets in trouble for posting kind of a careless Facebook comment. There's a gym teacher who gets a taste of a little bit of political power as he starts climbing the ranks in this right-wing political party and realizes what he will surrender and what he will do in order to secure his hold on that power. And there is an aspiring actress who dreams of being a movie star and takes these little budget acting classes and has perhaps the wildest dream in India and anywhere else, which is to have fame in the movies. And so what I can do is read just a little bit from the beginning. And this is the section about the person who gets in trouble for posting something on Facebook.
"You smell like smoke," my mother said to me. So I rubbed an oval of soap in my hair and poured a whole bucket of water on myself before a neighbor complained that I was wasting the morning supply.
There was a curfew that day. On the main street, a police jeep would creep by every half hour. Daily wage laborers compelled to work would come home with arms raised to show they had no weapons. In bed, my wet hair spread on the pillow, I picked up my new phone, purchased with my own salary, screen guard still attached. On Facebook, there was only one conversation, and the more I scrolled, the more Facebook unrolled. The night before, I had been at the railway station, no more than a 15-minute walk from my house. I ought to have seen the men who stole up to the open windows and threw flaming torches into the halted train. But all I saw were carriages burning, their doors locked from the outside and dangerously hot. The fire spread to huts bordering the station, smoke filling the chests of those who lived there. More than 100 people died. The government promised compensation to the families of the dead, 80,000 rupees, which, well, the government promises many things. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad you read from the beginning, because I wanted to ask you, I always like hearing where a book begins for a writer, like what, where it started for you, whether it was a voice or a scene, or can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think there are probably two origin stories that I can talk about. One is, I knew I wanted to say something about what was happening in India, this rise in hatred of the other, this turn to the right, and not just in India, you know, it was happening certainly here in the US, in Central Europe, in Brazil, in so many places around the world. And I wanted to write about how people still hold on to big dreams and still hold on to ambition and live with humor and joy in very hard conditions. So that was kind of what I knew I wanted to say in this book. And then once I started writing, I think one of the earliest images that I had was of this child fleeing on a train in this quest to improve their life and their parents' lives in some way. So the train image obviously remains strong in the book. And if you have a chance to read the book, I think you'll see that there's quite a bit here about the pain of seeing your parents challenged by the society around them, the pain of seeing your parents struggle and work really hard and be defeated by institutions that they live within. And so I think that moment of high emotion of a child wanting to do something wild and reckless for their parent, that was one of the kind of earliest registers that I had.
And you talked about kind of the three main characters, the three voices that the book shifts between. But there's also these interludes that I really loved throughout the book that are, some of them are very funny. Some of them are very jarring in a good way, where they're really violent, or they just take you out of the narrative, but they both take you out of it and like put you deeper in it in this way. And so how did, again, in kind of the process of how the book came to be, how did these interludes come to be a part of the story? And did their form and their role change as you worked on the book? Or can you talk about those a little bit?
The interludes, I think, came from a place of realizing that I could only write about three people with depth and nuance and give them story arcs, when I knew that there were so many possible stories that I could follow. And so in the interludes, I wanted to gesture toward how many particular and rich stories exist, and just kind of point to that a little bit. And like you said, I did hope that they would deepen who the minor characters in the book are. I wanted to show that they weren't just devices in these other people's lives. They had particular contradictions and struggles and aspirations of their own, and there were compromises that they had to make. So it was just a way of trying to write, I think, the most complex and unsimplified book I could write.
Well, it's great. You did a great job.
Thank you. So
I also hope people get a chance to read this. And you also work as an editor at Catapult. Can you talk a little bit about how your experience as an editor shapes your work as a writer, or doesn't? Maybe it doesn't, and vice versa. And we are talking in the time of shelter in place and quarantine, and how your roles as a writer, an editor, and a reader, what it's like to be a writer, an editor, and a reader right now, and how that might have changed for you.
I love being an editor, and an editor at Catapult specifically. Part of what I love about working at Catapult is that we take on I think really risk-taking, surprising books, and I always learn a lot from our books. So it feels like a really energizing and inspiring place to work. And even as a workplace, so many of my colleagues are writers and poets and artists, and it's just a really energizing place to work. And then in terms of, you know, how being an editor helps me be a better writer, I think because part of my job is to read a lot of manuscripts, over time, I gain a sense of what feels interesting to me in a story, what loses me in a story, what do I find surprising and pleasurable and exciting, and what do I find boring and dull. And I think it helps me sharpen those ideas for myself so that I can bring them to my own writing. And, you know, I was just finishing up edits on one of my author's books this morning, and it was just a reminder of how energizing it is to work very closely with another person's brilliant work. You know, to be so close to their sentences, to see what they're doing in each paragraph, to see how they are structuring a book, to see how they are bringing different subjects together. I work a lot on nonfiction, and I think that especially has proven really energizing to me because I feel like the kind of curiosity and exploration that I'm exposed to through the books that I work on is just an incredible source of fuel for me.
I like that idea of like constant learning. It's kind of like you just get to be in school forever, which is sort of what I would do if I had the resource time to do that. So that's great.
Sorry, you also asked about quarantine.
Oh yeah, just I feel like acknowledging this moment is important. And I just am curious about how the art making process has shifted. And
yeah, I think the thing about not having anywhere to go, a thing that I found hard in the early weeks of this was my work day took over my whole day. You know, my computer is here, I am here, I can answer an email anytime it comes in, you know. It was hard to put a beginning marker and an end marker to the work day, but then I started doing that more carefully. And I think it's better to have those boundaries in place.
Can you talk a little bit about what books or also maybe other media? I know movies, of course, play a big role in the story of a burning as well in a lot of ways, and TV and everything. What you kind of read and took in and different art that influenced the writing of a burning and the story of a burning, and whether it was for research or just books that were maybe touchstones or inspiration or aspiration for you?
I think this might not be exactly the answer that you're looking for, but what comes to mind for me is that I wanted it to be as propulsive and as easy to come back to as the most addictive television. And so I think there really are storytelling lessons in the magnetic pull a television show exerts on a viewer. And, you know, people joke about binge watching shows and that kind of thing, but I think there are craft lessons in that. Like, how do you keep someone coming back episode to episode? How do you make someone feel so invested in these characters that they need to know what happens? How do you generate that kind of storytelling velocity and energy? And I think I wanted to have that kind of energy in my book because I knew that I wanted the book to say intellectually serious things about the rise of the right and living in hard places. But I also wanted it to be an entertaining and inviting book, you know? I wanted it to be a book that you can come home from work and pick up and it rewards your time. And so I think paying attention to TV in a half playful and half serious way was really worthwhile for me.
I'm going to try this one question that I haven't quite formed yet.
Please.
So I'll cut it out if I don't succeed, but like I am genuinely curious about it. There's a lot of food in the book, and I feel like there's something about, and of course the book is dealing a lot with class, with like Javon wanting to rise to the middle class and the different struggles and PT and everything, but there's a lot of eating and there's a lot of food in the book. And I don't really have my question, but I wondered if you could kind of talk about the role of food for the characters and if they're just eating because people need to eat food, or if you thought about it more than that or anything.
Yeah, you're actually the first person to tell me that you noticed this, and I'm glad you did. I care about food, and I think food has so much to say about aspiration. There's a part in the book where a character looks at cooking videos online and thinks about, you know, all the fancy foods that people have in Western countries, like whipped cream that you can, you know, get from a can and that kind of stuff. And growing up in India, we were definitely exposed to all of these American things like, you know, burgers and, you know, ice cream sundaes and that kind of thing, which there was something so foreign and aspirational about them. And so much of this book has to do with aspiration, you know, has to do with that kind of longing to improve your life in some way. And so I think that's one of the ways in which food plugs into the book. And there are also some important conversations that take place around meals. And I'm Bengali, and food and meal times are so important to Bengalis. That's kind of what I grew up with. So coming together around a meal feels significant to me. It feels like an opportunity for people to have difficult conversations or for people to be introduced to something. And the context of that is always so interesting to me. Thank you for asking about that. I know that your question will also make me think further about what exactly I was doing.
That was Amanda Bullock in conversation with Megha Majumdar from Literary Arts podcast, Long Distance. In this next segment, Amanda talks to the writer Jean Kyung Fraser.
Hi, Jean. Thank you so much for calling in today on Zoom.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amanda. It's nice to be here. It's good to see your face. It's nice to do a podcast and be able to like see you talking back.
It is nice, actually. I have it set up so it's all you too, so that I don't have to look at myself, which I appreciate. but thank you so much. And I'm really looking forward to talking about Pizza Girl. I love the book so much, and
I'm so
excited about it. I thought we would start with a short reading, if you'd like to read a little bit. And if you could also tell us a little bit about the book and, you know, the phrase elevator pitch, but sort of the like elevator pitch.
No, I feel like I developed mine in bars during grad school because I didn't want to talk for very long. So I got this down to a T. One sentence: Pizza Girl is about a pregnant pizza delivery girl that falls into obsession with this older woman that she delivers to. And on that note, I'll get started with the quick reading. Just going to read everyone the first page. Her name was Jenny Hauser, and every Wednesday I put pickles on her pizza. The first time she called in, it had been mid-June, the summer of 2011. I'd been at Eddie's a little over a month. My uniform polo was green and orange and scratchy at the pits. People would loudly thank me and then tip me a dollar. At the end of shifts, my hair reeked of garlic. Every hour, I thought about quitting, but I was 18, didn't know how to do much of anything, 11 weeks pregnant. At least it got me out of the house. This morning, she'd called, Mom hugged me four times, Billy five, all before I'd pulled on my socks and poured milk over my cereal. They hurled I love yous against my back as I fast walked out the front door. Some days, I wanted to turn around and hug them back. On others, I wanted to punch them straight in the face, run away to Thailand, Hawaii, Myrtle Beach, somewhere with sun and ocean.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
The book is set in Los Angeles.
It is.
And you're calling from Los Angeles.
I am, yeah.
Which is your hometown, I believe.
I grew up in both LA and Minnesota area, but mostly all my formative years were in LA.
The landscape of LA seems to definitely play a role in the book to me. It's the city is deliberately mentioned. It's not vague where it's set. And the narrator spends a lot of time in her car.
Very LA thing to be in your car all the time.
Indeed. So in addition to that, I guess I kind of want to ask you like how you see the LA-ness of the story and maybe why you chose to set it in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, I simply chose to set it in Los Angeles just because, you know, it's like where I spent so much of my life and it's a city that means a lot to me. But it's interesting that I did write this book entirely when I was not living in LA, when I was living in New York. And I wonder if I like needed that space to maybe like think about LA, create it in my mind and then put it on to the page, you know, because it was like a fine line to walk where it's like, I don't like scenery description and I didn't want there to be like massive pages just all about LA, but I wanted its presence to be felt, you know, like to be this subtle backdrop, you know, it's not taking place anywhere. It is LA.
That makes sense to need a little distance from something to like be able to see it in a certain way.
Well, sometimes too, I feel like if I was writing this when I was in LA, I would have been a little bit more like, I have to get this exactly right. I have to make sure that this street lamp is here, that donut shop is there. And, you know, not that would have been bad. That would have, I'm sure, still been the same book it is. I feel like it just would have maybe restricted me a little and made it the book not flow as naturally for me. Like it would have, like, I kind of like that I was just constructing LA in my mind from memory.
Yeah, I like that too. That's maybe what's important is what you can remember and what is coming to you. And then you mentioned even in the part you read, it's explicitly set in the summer of 2011. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, well, one, that's the summer I graduated high school that summer. But two, I also feel like enough time has passed from then where it's like we're now having 2010s nostalgia.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that so weird to think about? Like we have now, we're in a new decade and there is something interesting about that moment. And I wanted to kind of write about what it was like to be like 18 in that moment. Like as much as the book is, I think in some ways, like it could be any time in the 2000s. Like I don't really mediate that long on technology or anything like that. It just felt like important to me that it was known that it was that year.
And then since you read the beginning too, and I always like to ask this question because I like to hear the answers. Could you talk a little bit about how the novel started for you, sort of how it came into being in the process of writing the book?
Yeah, for sure. I had a vague, for me, it's funny. I always feel like I have a first line. I had that first line her name was Jenny Hauser and every Wednesday I put pickles on her pizza. I've had that line since I was maybe like 22, even though I didn't start writing until I was like 24, you know, because there's just something, I delivered pizzas when I was 20 one summer. It was just a night job I had because I was working like an unpaid internship and I needed like extra money. To
like
make
actual money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Take note, companies, those unpaid internships are But yeah, I mean, I always knew I wanted to write like a delivery novel of some kind. I wasn't even sure it would be a delivery girl novel. But I knew I wanted it to be about sort of someone falling into obsession with this woman, this mysterious woman. And I think that first line came to me and it has like a little mystery, a little sexy in a weird way too. And immediately it sort of just makes you want to know, okay, who is Jenny Hauser and why is our narrator putting pickles on her pizza? You know, but the actual like themes and sort of the characters didn't really come until I'd been writing short stories for about 2 years and sort of saw that I was writing about really similar themes like, you know, addiction, young parenthood, the immigrant experience, Americanization in general. And I kind of wanted to see if there was a way I could do it cohesively in one thing. And I sort of had this realization. I was like, maybe this coming of age delivery novel could be how I do all this.
I read a piece you did, I think for your UK publisher, where you talked about some of this and you said that you thought it might be Pizza Boy for a little while. And I really liked what you said. So I'm just baiting you to kind of
talk
about how it maybe changed from Pizza Boy to Pizza Girl.
Yeah, of course. Wow, that's so fun that you read that. I was really uncomfortable with my sexuality, or if not, maybe uncomfortable is not the right word. But even when I was like out to my friends, I wasn't something I really talked about. And especially with writing, I was feeling it was so new to me and I was so shy about it that I didn't know if I was ready to talk about it. But you know, at the end of one of my workshops, we were out at the bar and one of my classmates was saying she really liked my work, but she kind of wished that I was writing like a female narrator, you know, like she felt like I wanted to do it and just wasn't sure how. And she was correct, because for so long it felt like the only way that I could talk about like romantic feelings or attraction towards women was through like a male voice. And I am so glad that I did not write Pizza Boy. I don't think that would have, I feel like it would have just been a boring short story, like a pretty forgettable one, you know. And I really do think I wrote Pizza Girl at the right time, when I was finally feeling a little bit more at home in my skin.
Pizza Girl has a better ring to it.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, exactly.
Also, speaking of the Pizza Girl herself, the cover is amazing.
Oh, I'm so glad you like it.
It's awesome. I know they say don't judge a book by its cover, but I was at Penguin Random House and like saw it sitting on somebody's, behind somebody's desk, and literally said, like, what is that? Give it to me.
So that's so fun to hear. Yeah, I love it. It's beyond my wildest dreams. You know, you hear so many cover horror stories, especially for women too. Oh my God, I had this professor that told me about how for one of her books, they made it look like ridiculous chick lit cover to just sell more copies and stuff like that. So I was very nervous that somehow someone would put like a silhouette of a woman on the cover of my book, you know, and just, it would look like a romance.
Headless.
Novel.
She'd have no head. They always have no head.
Exactly. But no, my editor asked me sort of like what book covers I liked. And I sent her a couple, but they weren't quite right. And I had this t-shirt from this pizza shop I like in Brooklyn, Roberta's. And so I sent her a picture of that t-shirt too. And then like 2 weeks later, she's like, me and the art director can't get that shirt out of our heads. So we found the artist and he's down to do the book. Is that cool with you? And I was like, yeah, that's f-ing awesome. I was like, I didn't even know that was a thing. So that's basically how the cover came to be. And he got that in like one go too. He got
that. Wow.
Isn't that crazy? 2 weeks. We changed some of the color stuff, but yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. My friend said it's like Great Gatsby meets Spring Breakers meets the Domino's app or something
it
like that.
It is though.
Yeah. The eyes in the cover.
It's true. I actually really like the Gatsby comparison. Well, speaking of other books, including Gatsby, maybe, are there other books or maybe even like films or TV shows or other art that you see in conversation with Pizza Girl?
That was always, yeah, no, I know what you mean. I guess the most easy ones that comes to mind, not to compare how good I am with these writers because they're amazing, but like My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Otessa Moshfegh, maybe. The Idiot, Elif Batuman. One I really loved that I hadn't read until I sold the book and I was talking to my editor's assistant, Kara. She brought up Chemistry by Weike Wing, and I'm so glad she did. She sent me a copy. That's one of my favorite books I think I've ever read. It's fantastic. It was. I felt touched to be compared to it, you know?
I love that book too.
Again, another slim, powerful book. I love books that can do a lot in a short space.
Me too. I love short stories, and I really like short books too. It's, you know, quality, not quantity.
Yeah, exactly.
More pages doesn't make you more important.
Yeah, I've always found, I was like, people have never been mad when I've said less, so.
I didn't mean that.
Just in general. No. Yeah, I'm just being funny.
And the book is very funny, too. I just want to, like, announce that to anybody listening to this. There's a lot of really good snatches of dialogue, and I actually hate when people are like, what's real in the fiction? But you said you did work as a pizza delivery person for a while. And I was just kind of curious, like, how much of those sort of like one-liners were things you picked up and remembered, and how many were things that came to you?
You know, it's like, because the book obviously is fiction. I've never been pregnant or anything like that. But the pizza parts, like, were the descriptions of the customers were probably the most true. There were a few that, like, you know, like lines that friends told me here and there. Like, I had a friend who, there's this one line about a guy who works at like cremates bodies for a living, and he says, like, I like to get high and burn bodies. That was something that's horrifying. My friend, I did not hear that one directly, but my friend told me that one, and I was like, can I put that in my book? That's insane. And he's like, yeah, for sure. So
we talked a little bit about the books that you kind of had in mind and that you think, and that this book is orbiting around or in conversation with. But I also wanted to ask if you had any reading recommendations, or if there's anything you've been reading lately
that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to someone about this the other day. It's a coincidence, but two of my favorite books I've read recently are also by like Asian writers, which is like so awesome to see. Well, one is How Much of These Hills is Gold by Sipam Zong, and then the other one is Days of Distraction by Alexandra Chang. They're both remarkable, and both debuts too. It's like intimidating as a fellow debut writer, but also just like really lovely to see them come out with such like amazing pieces of fiction.
And then kind of related to like, what are you reading now? I wanted to ask about what you're, I feel like this question has to be two parts right now because we are in such a strange time, about what your kind of writing process is like, and if it's changed, maybe it hasn't. And maybe you're not writing. I know I've been very distracted lately and have not been doing the things I usually do. So just kind of what life has been like for you as a writer the last couple months.
Totally. I mean, it's so like, time has changed and what it means to me is so different, and that like, you know, a day can really stretch to a week. At the same time, it can be like Thursday and I'm like, what the hell have I done this whole week? You know, so there's been periods where I've been very engaged, writing more than I might during non-quarantine times. But then there's been just as many periods where I can't write a word, you know, whether it's because of what's going on in the news, you know, the sadness everywhere, the vileness. Sometimes I think you just need to sort of be okay not writing and not doing anything productive. Like that just in general is like, which I've been glad to see people talking about, like being against that sort of productive environment. Like people like always being like, oh, you know, Shakespeare wrote this during this time. It's like, oh, who gives a f-? You know what I mean? It's like, I'm probably not going to do anything in this time. And that's fine. I just want to survive and come out the other side feeling as whole as possible. Maybe a better person too. Who knows?
I think it's hard to expect someone to write about something when they're in the middle of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I am worried about how much pandemic fiction I'm going to be reading in the next couple years of my life. But I mean, I know there's going to be people who do it really well, but I don't know if I'm going to be one of those people. Like, I don't know how I feel about this time yet. I don't know how to write about it. And I'm okay with that.
That was Amanda Bullock in conversation with Jean Keong Fraser from the literary arts podcast, Long Distance. In this next segment, Amanda talks with debut writer Kelly Jo Ford.
Well, hi, Kelly. Thanks so much for calling in today. It's nice to see you.
Hi, Amanda. Thank you for chatting with me about the book. It's good to see you too.
Are you in Virginia? Is that right?
I am. I'm in Richmond, Virginia.
If it's okay with you, I'd like to start by asking you to read a couple pages to start us off so people can get a feel for Crooked Hallelujah.
Yeah, sure. I would love to.
Thank you.
You bet. So I'll just read a couple of pages from the first story chapter. It's about two pages in, and I think it's pretty self-explanatory. It takes place in a fictional town in the Cherokee Nation in 1974. As a girl, Justine had pored over the pictures from Lula's time at Shalako Indian School, trying to see her mother in the stone-cold fox who stared out from the old photographs. Lula's clothes hung loosely, even more faded than the other girls in the pictures, but something about her gaze, framed by short black curls of all things, made it seem as if she were the only one in the photo. If Marilyn Monroe had come of age in an Indian boarding school, and had fierce brown eyes instead of scared blue ones, that would have been young Lula. Justine kept the old pictures in a box hidden in the top of the closet, where she kept her Rolling Stones and a mood ring, other forbidden things. She hadn't thought of the pictures in ages, but she did so now as she watched her mom in prayer. Lula whispered amen, caught Justine staring at her. Granny's out gathering wild onions with Aunt Celia, Justine said quickly. Late in the year for it, Lula said. She unrolled her nylon stockings and wiggled her toes in the air. In the way of Cherokee women, Lula could still make you feel that she held down the earth around her one moment and then seem almost like a girl the next. Did you do your homework? I swept and did the rugs too. My teeny, Lula said, calling her the nickname that had stuck when Justine's middle sister Josie hadn't been able to say her name. Together, they pushed the swing back and let it fall forward. Justine closed her eyes. In the cool air that had come with the night's rain, her mother's warmth felt nice, which made the words she had been practicing feel all the worse. Evenings like this make me wonder how a body would want to set their bones anywhere other than these hills, Lula said. Justine opened her eyes. The two-bedroom house they rented with her granny sat on the edge of Beulah Springs, the outer walls almost as much tar paper as asphalt shingle. She had her own room now that her sisters had married themselves out of state, but her mother and granny still split a room barely big enough for one. Hand-sewn curtains strung on a clothesline separated their beds. The low green hills beyond the train tracks seemed like folds in a crumpled blanket after Dee sent her pictures of Tennessee mountains. Justine had a good idea why a body might light out for other hills, other lands. I talked to Daddy. Her nerves blurted it out for her. Lula put her feet down to stop the swing. Justine couldn't read her mother's face, but she wished she could put the words back in her mouth, swallow them for good.
Thank you. It was great to hear you read. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then I wanted to ask, I might have missed it, so forgive me if I did, but I don't think the phrase Crooked Hallelujah appears in the book. And so I was curious where the title came from. You're really good at titles too. Each story or chapter has its own title and they're great. So I wanted to ask about the book title.
I do not know where Crooked Hallelujah came from. I feel like it was sort of plucked out of the air early on. And it always felt like the name of the book. Yeah, it was always there. So I don't know where it came from, but it felt right. And as I worked on it, you know, for a long time, I felt open. You know, I talked about other titles with people, friends, my agent, and I was always open, but nothing ever felt right for the book.
It's perfect. So
thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to hear that because I never felt like this is obviously the title. I just felt like it feels right. You know, it's sort of a gut thing. And I was open to other gut things, but nothing happened. So thank you. It's fun. And it's funny that you say that I'm good at titles of the stories, the story chapters, because I feel like they're incredibly hard for me. So
yeah,
thank you.
I feel like I'm not a writer, but I feel like if I was, I would be, like everything would be untitled. It just, I don't know, but they're such a nice entry. And I do think you're very good at titles.
Thank you. I rely a lot on songs, and it's something I'm thinking about. I just wrote a playlist for Large Hearted Boy. And so I was thinking about how much I use both popular, you know, songs through the generations, you know, because the book spans decades, as well as gospel hymns. And so I think that in not all of the titles, but in most of them, you can feel that influence coming through.
Yeah, there are some touchstone songs in the book for sure. And I wanted to ask if there were different pieces of art, music, or other books or other writers who are what you see in conversation with your book, whether that's aspirational or influential or research or just kind of what other work you see in conversation with Crooked Hallelujah.
Sure. That's a really, really good question. So I think that the Rilo Kiley song, Better Son, Daughter, I feel like Justine, her arc over the course of the book, that song could be like Justine's soulmate. You know, I feel like if Justine had run across that song at the right moment in her life, maybe her life would be different because maybe she would understand that she's not the only one carrying both this like love that's weighted with shame in terms of how she relates to some members of her family. I just feel like that song, I love that song for Justine. And so that's why later on there's You'll Be Honest, You'll Be Brave, one of the stories that's about Justine going home to care for her ailing mother comes from that song. And I feel like that song, it's beautiful in that it captures, you know, one moment it just has like your heart singing, then the next minute it's breaking it. So that's one song that I would love for the book to be in conversation with. In terms of books, I was in great way, writing my way toward Love Medicine. That was Louise Erdrich's, I think it was called a novel. I think of it as, you know, I first as a reader and a lover of the book thought of it as stories. Although clearly it's telling, it has an arc over the course of a book and it's telling a bigger story so well. I love short stories. And so that's how I always thought of that book. But that's a book that I read over and over, and that I thought a lot about as I was trying to figure out how to both maintain the integrity of each individual story as its own complete movement, and then stitch that together to do something like bigger and I don't know, not more ambitious, because I don't think it's easy to write a short story. So I went back to Love Medicine again and again, and other novels and stories and linked collections, a Dylan Landis book called Normal People Don't Live Like This, and then also just reading interviews with Erdrich and, you know, just trying to soak up every bit of wisdom and grace that I feel like she has. And I mentioned earlier trying to figure out where to start the book, and that's that those two books were great inspirations and really useful for me. Dylan Landis, who wrote Normal People Don't Live Like This, something she wrote of her study of Love Medicine, which she also went to. I feel like there's just like a generation of people wanting to write novel and stories who are studying Love Medicine as a text. There should be, I think. But Put the Engine of the Book Up Front is something that Dylan Landis has written about Love Medicine, you know, and that's something that I worked on so long trying to figure out how to start the book in a way that both introduces the culture, like the religion, and a place in this particular family. I felt like it felt like a tall order, and do so in a way that provides a thrust for the story. And so those were books that I went back to a lot over those years.
Yeah, the combination of the Rilo Kiley quote and the Lori Moore quote in the beginning, I was like, I'm gonna like this book. This is gonna work out.
That's great. That's great. Thank you. But also the Lori Moore book, Birds of America, was another one that I went to. And I feel like this is a lesson that I'm still working on. But Lori Moore, her ability to, again, like just take you through a range of emotions, break your heart, and have you laughing in the next moment. You know, she was another one. That I don't know how much of that I absorbed and is reflected in the book, but I really, really admire that. And it's sort of just like, you know, you read a master and you know you're in the hands of a master when that's you're being taken through the range.
Well, this definitely, you broke my heart and made me laugh. So for me, for this reader. But well, that's what like life's like, right? Like nothing's perfectly sad or perfectly happy. It's all mixed up. I wanted to ask too, you mentioned the section you read mentions religion and you mentioned faith too, and it's such a huge part of the book, connects and separates the characters both, and their relationships like to it change throughout the book, of course. Can you talk a little bit more about how you see the role of faith and religion in the book?
Sure. I think that it varies by character. And for me, that's really appropriate, because I think for some people, a really rigid practice of beliefs and faith like really works well for them in their lives. And I respect that and I admire that. But then I feel like you have a character like Justine for whom it just really doesn't. And one thing that I like about following Justine, like starting when she's a teenager and following her over the course of nearly her entire life, is I feel really compelled by this idea of how faith and belief, you can carry that with you, particularly when you're raised in a fundamentalist faith and you reject it. And in Justine's case, in a great way, you are rejected by it, which is maybe even harder when you're told from the time you're very young that this is the one true way. And then you feel rejected by that way. And I feel like Justine carried that over the course of her life and was still struggling with it almost to the last moment we see her. And so I guess that's sort of where my interest lies in terms of faith and belief and the book and that particular character. And then Justine's daughter, Rini, you know, I think she is not really affected by it, but she only had that sort of religion on like the edges of her existence. So, you know, you see her and she's not really struggling with those questions at all.
Yeah. You mentioned
the last moment we see Justine, and I don't believe in spoilers, so I don't think this is a spoiler. The last story in the book is, so most of the book is set in specific times. We even get year signals and different things like that, and roughly the present. And then we jump to the near future, and it is apocalyptic. It's described directly as apocalyptic. And I just wanted to hear more from you about the process of writing that story and how you chose to include it. And I loved it. It was great. But it is this like distinct jump from the rest of the book in this way.
It absolutely is. And thank you. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. So that is a story that, like, I think on a personal note, like, I'm clearly reliving now in global pandemic and massive righteous social uprising. And I'm a person who's been sort of like one eye on the apocalypse sort of my whole life. I don't know why, like, having been raised in a pretty religious family, maybe like anxiety, who knows? But, you know, my mom was having like sort of this series of things happen, like wildfires and tornadoes. So that those were some things that were happening. And I guess I just took that into my imagination, imagining that, you know, an apocalyptic event contained to one place. And that felt like an interesting place to jump off for a story. So that's sort of where it came from. And can you remind me of the rest of your question?
Oh yeah, it wasn't really a question. I cheated and did that thing. Like, can you speak more to, which I've like embraced as an interviewer. I'm like, I just want to talk about this story and I don't have like a specific question about it. But it does, I guess it is true. I said it was a big jump, but really just in time, like the weather is violent, like throughout the book, there's all these violent weather events, like tornadoes and fires and everything. So it does all, it makes sense as a culmination in this way.
Yeah, I hope so. I was, you know, hoping that as the book progressed, like there is sort of the weather's becoming more violent and there's more mention of drought and heat. And as, you know, Justine is raised in the faith that preaches that there will be, you know, that there this time will come. And so I was hoping that it all sort of came together in that final story, you know, the weather events that are happening, the questions of faith and belief, and then the relationship between the mother and the daughter. And it's interesting. It is certainly a leap. And then on the other hand, it's sort of like, oh, you wake up one day in an apocalyptic existence, and then you look back and you realize like, oh, this has been happening. This has been building all along. It sort of seems like, oh, it's not so near future or far-fetched at all.
Yeah, I mean, now it's like, right. It doesn't seem far-fetched. Yeah.
Right. It's like, you just have this normal story and then suddenly you're living in the apocalypse.
Those were interviews from our podcast, Long Distance, hosted by Amanda Bullock. She spoke to writers Megha Majumdar, Jean Kyung Fraser, and Kelly Jo Ford. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from The Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for The Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Krista Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to Amanda Bullock and Liz Olofsson, and to the whole Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.